create our motivation. This life appears so vividly, so strongly to us, and we are completely under the power of our sense perceptions. Whatever we perceive with our senses, we believe is true as it appears to us. So not only do we believe everything that we perceive as existing in the way it is, as it appears to us, we also have a very small mind and think that this is all that exists. So we don't have any space in our mind to really question what appears to us. Is it a correct appearance? Is it incorrect? Is the way I'm conceiving of the world correct or incorrect? And these are actually quite important questions and important things to investigate, because how we live our life depends on the answers we come up with in examining these things. When we don't examine them and simply believe whatever appears to our senses, then we get wrapped up in thinking that happiness and suffering come from outside of us, and that leads us into our samsaric struggle for happiness as we struggle with the external world, trying to be happy. So all living beings suffer from this contrived view, this mistaken, erroneous view, just as we do. And so as we do our Dharma practice, we want to understand reality, to remove the obscurations from our own mind, so that we can be of service to others and help them remove the obscurations from their minds. And so it's with this loving, compassionate aspiration to attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all beings that we'll listen to teachings and discuss them today. So as many of you know, one of our long-term DFFers, Bonnie Olson, passed away about 10 days ago or so. Is Chris here? Your son? No? Okay. Anyway, Bonnie was an attorney, and she had a court case a week ago Tuesday, and you know, usually comes to DFF that evening, but the case went long, so she went home, and she spent the evening watching movies and playing video games with her son Chris, and then went to bed, you know, like any old day, and didn't wake up the next morning. She died in her sleep. They weren't sure of what. They thought maybe a heart attack. But I was thinking, you know, when we have this vision of this life, you know, this life appears so real, so strong, everything we see seems to really be there and to be quite permanent. And so we never think about our own mortality, you know. And when Bonnie went to bed that Tuesday night, she probably didn't think, you know, I'm going to die in my sleep. And, you know, within 24 hours, I'm going to be having a whole different vision appearing to my mind. Yeah? And yet, you know, that's exactly what happened. So even though everything looks so real, so permanent, so out there, And we develop this whole identity with it. You know, this is me, this is mine, this is who I am. Actually, the whole thing's gone like that. You know, why? Because it doesn't exist the way it appears. It appears permanent. It isn't. It appears out there and solid with its own existence. It isn't. And so not realizing that, then when reality exists and shows its face, we're like dumbfounded, going, hey, it's not supposed to happen like that. I was, when Chris, her son, contacted me, it was very nice because he wasn't Buddhist, but he wanted to know how to help his mom, you know. And so I've known Bonnie for many years. She's come to DFF many times, gone mountain retreats. And I knew that she was very fond of the Chenresi practice. And so I told him about that. And he went in the bedroom as we were talking on the phone, and her book was right there on the bedstand, you know. And he told me that she usually meditated every morning and evening, and the mala and her dharma books were right there on the bedstand. So I thought that was quite good. You know, that was, you know, something quite positive. And, you know, and it was so nice that he was able to find that. And then I contacted a number of the DFFers who I knew, who met and at the center and did the Chenresi practice for Bonnie and did it also last week. And I said, you know, every week for 7 weeks is good to do for her. So last night after teachings, I was talking with Tom, because he was one of the ones I had put Chris, Bonnie's son, in touch with. And Tom came up to me and said, thank you so much for giving us an opportunity to help like this and to participate like this. He said it was so moving to be able to do the Chenresi practice for Bonnie and to be able, as DFF, you know, DFFers, to come together as a community. So I thought that was very moving, the way the community here really supports each other and helps each other in that way, and how he felt privileged to be able to help. I mean, what a beautiful attitude, don't you think? So I think it's good if we, you know, all make prayers for Bonnie the rest of these 5.5 weeks, and hope that she will have another precious human life with the opportunity to practice the Dharma and meet good teachers and progress along the path. And I think if we can learn something from her death, then it gives some meaning to her having died so you know, suddenly, without any of us expecting it. Yeah. So whenever things like this happen, we need to take it as something that gives meaning to our own Dharma practice. My teachers used to tell a story of one disciple who would go to his teacher, went to his teacher and said, you know, please, will you tell me when I'm going to die? And the teacher said, okay. And so... Or maybe the teacher didn't say anything. And then after that, you know, every once in a while, the student would get different messages from his teacher. You know, oh, so and so died, please make prayers. Mm. Next week, oh, so and so died, please, you know, dedicate to them. And this went on for a while, and then all of a sudden, you know, the disciple fell very deathly ill, and teacher came to see him, and the disciple said, hey, how come you didn't warn me that I was going to die now? I'm terminally ill. And the teacher said, I was warning you the whole time. Yeah? So, you know, when we hear about other people dying, we always think that's other people. It has nothing to do with us. It's not a warning of our own mortality. But it is, isn't it? It is. Yeah. And someday DFFers, if we're lucky, will be gathered together doing Chenresi practice and dedicating for us. But meanwhile, we're off in the intermediate stage somewhere, you know, having a whole different karmic appearance. And what we get reborn as after that intermediate state is going to depend on what karma we created, you know, how much purification we did, what we spent our time thinking about and doing and speaking and communicating while we were alive. Okay? So instead of thinking, you know, I'll do Dharma practice later, you know, like right before I die, I'll squeeze a little bit Dharma practice and create some good karma, you know. And that's good to do right before we die, but if we were going to die tomorrow, then we should be doing that today. Don't you think? And we don't know when death is going to come. It might be tomorrow. It might not. We might not make it till tomorrow. Okay? So it's important to use a memory, a recollection of our own mortality to help us think about what's important and set our priorities in life, and to really let go of all the kind of useless, angry, resentful, disgruntled thoughts that so often just, you know, are like waves crashing all over the landscape of our mind. Because if you think about the things you got irritated about yesterday, would you want to die thinking about those things? No, no. Or the things that you felt dissatisfied about? Forget yesterday. How about this morning? I'm sure we've felt some dissatisfaction this morning. So things haven't gone the way we've wanted. We've gotten irked or whatever. Do we want to die thinking about that? No. So why spend our time living thinking about it? Yeah. So, you know, even the little things that go up, but then especially the big things, you know, how we build so much identity. You know, I'm the person that was nobody appreciates. I'm the person that was abused. I'm the person that's unloved and unlovable. I'm the person who other people betrayed my trust. I'm the person who never gets the fair deal. I'm the person who, you know, okay? I'm sure we could each write down 10 identities very quickly that we get stuck in. But are we those identities? And do we want to die clinging onto that identity? And if it's not real and if it's not us, then why do we spend so much time being absorbed in it? You know, thinking, oh, that's me. That's me. You know, that person did that to me. It's like they're no longer here doing it to us. So might as well let go, relax. Yeah? Okay, so that's one thing I want to talk about. Then, there were a few more things about the monastic conference that I thought to mention, and some of it was in response to James' question last night about women in the Dharma. But one thing about that first is there were, I don't know, around 40 of us, maybe 38 or something, but we added up all of our ordination years. And we came to over 650. Yeah? So I think that's really something if you think of that in, you know, this country. And that was just a small gathering of us, you know, having over 650 years of ordination. The youngest one who was ordained was 6 months, and the longest one was 38 years. And there were quite a number of people who were ordained over 20 years. Yeah, quite a number. And we had the at these meetings, you know, where we are together, both monks and nuns, because it's America, we relate very equally to each other. Now, according to where we meet, sometimes there's a little bit of difference. Last year, we met at a Theravada center, and they're usually the ones where, you know, the nuns are really in the back. But Bhante Gunaratana, who was the abbot there, is very forward-thinking. He's really terrific. And so when we went in, because we always do a procession with our bowls to receive the alms and the food that's being offered to us. He had us do it by ordination, you know, seniority, mixed men and women. Mm. Yeah, which was very nice. Now, the temple we were at this time was a Chinese temple. And they, you know, the nuns there have the full ordination, but they very much, you know, the monks go first when there's processions and things. So that happened, but in all the seating in the dining room, we were side by side. And then when we sit for our sessions together, we're all mixed up, you know, and sometimes the juniors are sitting in front, the seniors are sitting in back. The first night I was sitting next to the abbot of Shasta Abbey. He, you know, we're both 30 plus years of ordination. And I turned to him and I said, isn't it nice to sit in the back row? And he said, people really don't appreciate it. How do you say anonymity when you're anonymous? Anonymity? Whatever that word is. Okay, that one. yeah. And then, on the second to last day, I gave people an update about the progress about the Bhikshuni ordination, because we're trying to establish it in the Tibetan tradition and hopefully in the Theravada tradition as well. So I gave an update on that, and you know, we had a lot of discussion. You know, people are very supportive of it. And then after that, the Bhikshunis, we did our posada. Posada, or sojourn in Tibetan, is a ceremony that we do every new and full moon to confess any breaches in our precepts and to restore our precepts. So we do some confession, and then the senior usually reads our precepts out while we listen. And so at that time, other people aren't allowed to be in the room, and so the Bhikshunis went. There were 15 Bhikshunis there, and we went into another room. Well, actually, there were more Bhikshunis who were part of the temple, but they weren't able to attend at this time. So there were 15 of us. And the senior nun, the one who was ordained there for 38 years, she was the senior of all the monks and nuns, she read the Pratimoksha, which is the list of our precepts. And then afterwards, one of the junior nuns, because there's very much this custom in, you know, in the monastic community of showing respect to the elders and those who have been ordained. And so she requested that the Mahateris, those who have been fully ordained for 20 years or more, sit in the front. And then all the ones who were junior, they bowed, and this one nun on their behalf asked us for advice for practice. So there were four of us who had been fully ordained more than 20 years. And so each of us, you know, said a few words of advice, and then they bowed again and thanked us. And there was something very beautiful about that whole tradition and the whole way that the juniors and the seniors relate to each other and help each other and respect each other. And one of the nuns who had never had the opportunity to do the posada together with other Bhikshunis, when we walked out, she was in tears. You know, she was so moved by the whole thing. So this is something special, I think, that's happening with Buddhism in America, where we had all these nuns we were all in the Dhammaguptaka Vinaya, but from different practice traditions, you know, because there was Vietnamese and Korean and Theravada and, you know, Sri Lanka Theravada and Thai Theravada and Tibetan and, you know, and yet we're all doing our confession and restoration ceremony together and acting as a Bhikshuni community. It was really very beautiful. Okay. So I think that's something that bodes well for Buddhism here, and may it continue to occur throughout the centuries. Yeah. And then another thing that happened on my trip was yesterday afternoon, after I landed in Seattle, Venerable Tien, who's a student, a grad student, or your grad or post-grad? Grad, okay. Soon to be post-grad. You know, there's life before the dissertation and life after the dissertation. So, anyway, she asked, she very kindly invited us to come on Friday afternoon, a group of people. You may have heard that Professor Richards, is his name, Solomon at UW, has these ancient texts that were found in the Gandhar region, yeah, and they're in the British Museum now. And I realized I had seen a presentation from him many, many years ago at UW after these manuscripts had been found. They're the oldest Buddhist manuscripts that have been found so far, and they're 2,000 years old. And so they had taken pictures. They had unrolled these manuscripts and taken pictures of them. And then Venerable Tien and three others, every Friday afternoon, they meet to transcribe what's written on these manuscripts and to puzzle it out, because, you know, sometimes the manuscript's frayed here, it's broken there, you can't tell what the letters are, or, you know, some parts easy to read, some parts more difficult to read. And they are transcribing it, you know. And it was incredible sitting in that room. Mary Grace drove me there, and we talked about it afterwards, and we were so moved, because sitting there thinking, you know, somebody wrote this text 2,000 years ago, you know, with a motivation of compassion so that other people could learn the Dharma. And they wrote it with ink that was, what was it? Ash cooked in cow urine. Okay? That was the ink on birch bark. Yeah? And, you know, painstakingly writing this huge text, it looked like an Abhidharma text. It had sutra and then commentary on the sutra passages. You know, writing this out of compassion so that other people can learn the Dharma. And not knowing who at all would read this text. And I'm sure people at his time, you know, read the text. But they had no idea that 2,000 years later, you know, there was going to be these people in the student lounge in Bowen Hall, you know, transcribing what he wrote. And I'm sitting there thinking, wow, I wonder what kind of karmic connection we have with, you know, this person. Was it the author writing his own text, or was it a teacher dictating it to one of his students who, you know, acted as the scribe? And then I started thinking, wow, can you imagine, maybe in 4007, somebody's going to find one of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's books. You know? And they're going to sit and be transcribing it and trying to figure out what His Holiness wrote. Can you imagine that? I mean, think of the time, 4007, 2,000 years later. You know? I mean, it's just incredible to think about, and how the Dharma has existed in our world so long and, you know, been passed down like this. It's really, really inspiring. So thank you so much for enabling us to do that. Yeah. Okay. So those were just some afterthoughts I had that I forgot to mention to you yesterday. Yeah. I should probably get on with what I'm supposed to talk about today. Okay, so in the Great Treatise on the Stages of the Path, you know, which was translated into English finally, and actually next summer, July 08, His Holiness is going to be teaching this text on the East Coast, because the people they formed a team that translated it, and I think that they asked His Holiness, you know, while they were translating it, please to come and teach it after it was finished. So I think that's what's happening. So it's chapter 22. It's called The Attitude of a Person of Medium Capacity. Okay. So like I said yesterday, this is somebody who has really seen the disadvantages of cyclic existence and wants to be free and has this very much as a present awareness in their mind all the time. You know, for us, our renunciation, our wish to attain liberation, it comes and goes, doesn't it? You know? And it's a little bit intellectual. When we're having a good time, it's gone. Yeah? When we're suffering, then we begin to think about the Dharma and we think, oh yeah, this body is in the nature of dukkha. It might be good to attain liberation. And then as soon as we get well, again, it's gone. Yeah? That's for some people. Other people, when they're well, then they think, oh yeah, I really, you know, want to practice and attain liberation. And then when they get sick, they go, oh, I'm so sick. Mommy, take care of me. You know? And they forget Dharma at that time. Yeah. So it's quite interesting. Some people forget Dharma when they're well. Other people forget Dharma when they're sick. Other people forget it all the time. Yeah. We want to become somebody who doesn't forget it any of the time. Okay? Who has that awareness in our mind all the time. Okay, so the first section in this chapter, it's called the measure of the determination to be free. So how you know when you have attained this. So Jay Rinpoche says, you must understand in detail the characteristics of cyclic existence, both by way of suffering and its origin, and by way of the 12 factors of dependent arising. So yesterday we talked about suffering and its origin, and then at a previous visit to DFF I talked about the 12 links of dependent arising. So that's on the website. Once you understand these characteristics, you will develop a desire to abandon and to quell suffering and its origin. So suffering here, he's meaning dukkha. At this point, although you may have a simple determination to be free, you should not be satisfied merely with this. Okay, so we have our simple determination to be free. Hence, Chandrakirti's commentary on the 60 stanzas of reasoning says, and this is a quote from Chandrakirti, who lived 7th century in India, once we are certain that living in the three levels of existence, impermanence's blazing fire, is like entering a burning house, we want to escape it. And as cited previously, just as when a chance arises for prisoners to flee from prison. Okay, so this is how we should feel about samsara, that we are in a burning house. Yeah, if you're in a burning house, are you going to sit down and watch your favorite TV program? Yeah? No, what's going to be the first thing on your mind if your house is on fire? You're going to get out, aren't you? Yeah? And if you have some compassion, you're going to take the rest of your family and your pets with you. Hmm? Yeah. If you're a prisoner, yeah, what does a prisoner feel all the time? Get me out of here. Okay? So if you have a chance to escape as a prisoner, are you going to sit and read a novel in your cell? No. Yeah, you're going to take the opportunity. So we want to have this aspiration for liberation that's strong in our mind. So, you know, we have the opportunity right now to escape from the prison, to get out of the burning house. So let's do it. So Jay Rinpoche continues, develop an attitude about cyclic existence like those who feel aversion for their confinement in a blazing house or a prison and want to escape. Then progressively increase this feeling of aversion and desire to escape. Okay, so at the beginning, you know, we have some aversion to samsara and some wish to get out, but we need to really keep on meditating on the disadvantages of samsara, the path out of it, the 12 links, the path to reverse the 12 links, so that we continue to nourish our determination to be free. Sharawa, which is one great Tibetan sage, okay, described a superficial determination to be free as being like when you pour powder into inferior beer. The powder forms just a thin layer on the surface. This is one of those esoteric examples. You know, sometimes the Tibetan teachings, it's like they give an example and you're going, what was that? So anyway, any of you who have poured powder on inferior beer, maybe you can explain it to us. But I guess the thing is, it's like a layer on the surface. So maybe we could say it's like when you don't wash your dishes well, and then you fill your glass up with water, and there's skin, you know, on the surface. You're cooking lentils and all the what do you, skin? Foam? Whatever it is, you know, it like, yeah. Froth. Yeah, so all that is on the surface. So that's kind of like our superficial determination to be free. Okay, let's just, you know, skim off that level of dukkha and, you know, in other words, it's what I call tweaking samsara. Okay? We want to tweak our samsara, how we can just improve our samsara. So actually, you know, a lot of us, when we first come to Buddha's teachings, this may be what we're looking for. You know, we've never heard of samsara. We've never heard of liberation. Yeah? And so we come to the Dharma because we're stressed out, or we have pain, or we're upset, or somebody died and we're grieving. We're looking for something to make us feel better. And so we may initially come with that motivation, and we learn some techniques to work with our anger and our attachment and how to process all these things. And then we're satisfied with that. Okay. We may have heard a little bit about renunciation and the determination to be free, and we think, oh yeah, that's good, but I'm kind of satisfied. I'm not as angry as I used to be. I've reconciled with the person I was upset with, you know, so life is better now. Yeah, and so for that person, Dharma has benefited them at that level. That's good. Okay, but it's like the froth on your lentils, okay? You know? If you hang around long enough, then you keep hearing, oh, renunciation, determination to be free, wish for liberation. You start going, what are they talking about? Okay? And then you start meditating on the disadvantages of cyclic existence and its causes and the path to liberation and the 12 links and all these things. And you begin to build some sort of actual wish for liberation. And that's when your Dharma practice really takes off. You know? Because when you have that, then you keep showing up. Mm-hmm. If you don't keep showing up for Dharma, what's happened is you've forgotten the disadvantages of cyclic existence, and you've forgotten that you're going to die one day. Okay? So if you find yourself you know, writing the book of 5,003,9248 excuses. Yeah? Why I can't get to teachings, why I can't go on retreat, why I can't do a daily practice, da 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 da. You know, instead of saying, what went wrong? Yeah? And instead of writing me an email saying, what do? I'm telling you right now, okay? What's gone wrong is that we've forgotten we're in samsara, and we've forgotten that we're going to die. That's basically what's happened. And so how to invigorate our Dharma practice? Then we need to, you know, meditate on death and impermanence, meditate on the disadvantages of samsara, the benefits of attaining liberation. Okay? Meditate on compassion for sentient beings, realizing that they're in the same situation as we are. And then in that way, we get more energy through having developed our wisdom, and our Dharma practice takes off again. That and a little bit of self-discipline. That's what we need. We have lots of self-discipline to watch television. Yeah, lots of self-discipline when it comes to making money. You know, you'll be tired and you'll work late at work, won't you? Yeah? But when you're tired, will you sit down to meditate? No. Okay? So, you know, we need to invigorate our enthusiastic perseverance for the Dharma, because we know that it's actually what's going to bring us happiness. Okay? So we practice Dharma not out of guilt, not out of shoulds, but because we know that it's the path to happiness and we want to be happy. Okay? So, you know, when we're trying to, if we see samsara as a house on fire or as a prison, yeah, on one side we're seeing the disadvantages, but on the other side we're thinking of the benefits of liberation and how, you know, wonderful it's going to be liberated. And I can tell you from the correspondence I have with inmates, they think a lot about what it's going to be like to be on the outside. Yeah? So in the same way, we should, you know, think, oh, what's it going to feel like to be liberated? What's it going to feel like to attain Buddhahood? Oh, wow. That's going to be nice. Okay? And so then that encourages us. Okay. If your ability to see the undesirability of true origins, the causes of cyclic existence, is superficial like this, then your search for liberation, the cessation of suffering and its origin, will be the same. Okay? So basically, whatever our level of motivation is, that determines how much we practice. Likewise, your desire to attain the path to liberation will be mere words. That one's embarrassing, isn't it? I'm like, ugh, he's right. Thus, you will not be able to develop either the compassion that cannot bear to see the sufferings of living beings in cyclic existence, or the uncontrived spirit of unsurpassed enlightenment that instills you with strength. Okay, so if we can't... Well, let me finish the paragraph here. Hence, your understanding of the Mahayana will also be merely intellectual. Therefore, you must practice these teachings for the person of medium capacity and regard them as crucial instructions. Okay? So, you may wonder, well, wait a minute. You know, the bodhicitta teachings, love, compassion, I like those. Yeah, they make me feel good. Don't they? You know, develop love and compassion for sentient beings. But meditating on the first two noble truths, dukkha, the causes of dukkha, I don't like that one so much. So let's skip that one and let's go on to love and compassion. Well, what Jay Rinpoche is saying here is that we can't really develop true love and compassion if we skip over meditating on dukkha and its origins. Why? Because compassion is the wish for sentient beings to be free of suffering. We can't wish them to be free of suffering if, number one, we can't wish ourselves to be free of suffering, and number two, if we don't fully comprehend what suffering is. Okay? So if we try and cultivate compassion without really understanding what cyclic existence is, then our compassion becomes very superficial. You know, somebody, and it becomes compassion for people who have physical pain. Remember I was saying yesterday about that, the three kinds of dukkha? And, you know, we all have, you know, it's fairly easy for compassion to arise for beings with physical pain. But for beings who have the dukkha of change, okay? In other words, people who are wealthy, who seem to be doing very well, the movie stars, all the people you're jealous of, you know, having compassion for them, that's a little bit harder. Yeah, and having compassion for those who have the pervaded, compounded dukkha, that's harder. But if we're really going to have stable compassion, we have to understand those levels of dukkha. Okay? And we have to understand them, not just that others have them, but that we have them. Okay, because it's always easier to understand when we think of the Dharma in terms of our own life. Okay, so we contemplate the disadvantages of samsara for ourselves, and then when we have the strong wish to be free, which is having compassion for ourselves, then all we do is think of other sentient beings as having that same kind of dukkha, coming from the same origins, and then very easily compassion arises for them. Okay? So that's why it's important to do this meditation. And so many people nowadays talk about compassion. You know, I want to love myself. I want to have compassion for myself. And so the pop psychology way to do it is to go to the shopping mall and buy something. Okay? In the airport yesterday, I saw a sign. And it said, "This is a shopping mall with an airport in it." You know? And that's how they're trying to encourage people to buy more stuff. You know, you're in a shopping mall that has an airport. You know? So buy stuff because it'll make you happy. But it doesn't, and it uses up more of the world's resources, and it creates more pollution and more global warming and more garbage. Yeah? And it doesn't really make us happy. So if we really want to love ourselves, we don't show that by, you know, buying ourselves, you know, the 20th pair of shoes, you know, for 2 feet, 20 pairs of shoes is a bit much, don't you think? Yeah? So instead of thinking that loving ourselves is that, no, you don't think? Amelda Marcos is going to be jealous. You know, to really think about this, and, you know, loving ourselves means wanting ourselves to be happy. Well, the real happiness is the happiness of liberation and enlightenment. So really loving ourselves means loving the Dharma, which is the path to enlightenment and the cessations of dukkha. That's what it really means to love ourselves. Having compassion for ourselves, wanting ourselves to be free of suffering, that means, again, wanting to practice the Dharma, because we want ourselves to be free of all the misery and all of its causes forever. Yeah? So we have to really think what loving ourselves means and having compassion for ourselves means, because that's really what it means. Yeah? Do you think that you really love yourself when you go out and buy something that you don't need and add up to your credit card debt? I mean, so many people in this country are in credit card debt, and yet they go buy more stuff. Is that loving yourself? Is that being kind to yourself? Putting yourself in credit card debt so that your life is frozen and you can't move because you have all these debts piled on your head? You know, even just looking this life, you know, is that being kind to yourself in this life? I don't think so. But if you really think, if you do some Dharma practice, this life goes better, then future lives go better, then, you know, quicker to enlightenment and liberation. Okay, then the second section, Jay Rinpoche called Dispelling Misconceptions. Yeah, so we have lots of misconceptions, so he's going to dispel them here. And this is a very interesting section, okay? So somebody raises the qualm. Generally, in the text, when somebody raises a qualm, the Tibetan is ka-cheek. Ka-cheek means one mouth.
Okay? So one mouth, or one big mouth, raises the following doubt. Okay? We put it more politely, you know. We put qualm. Maybe kashuk is okay. It's polite in Tibetan, but literally translated. Okay. So the qualm is, although it is appropriate in the fundamental vehicle to cultivate disenchantment with cyclic existence, it is inappropriate for bodhisattvas. Okay? So this person is saying it's inappropriate for people who are bodhisattvas, who aspire to follow the bodhisattva path, to cultivate disenchantment with cyclic existence. For if bodhisattvas were to cultivate intense disgust and disenchantment with cyclic existence, they would be like the hearers, those who strive only for liberation, not full enlightenment, and they would fall into an extreme of peace, in other words, their own peace of nirvana, having become displeased with their involvement in cyclic existence. Okay, so this person is saying, if you follow the bodhisattva path, if you develop disenchantment and disgust with cyclic existence, then you're going to follow, you wind up following the hearer path that just leads to arhatship, and you're going to give up your bodhicitta. Okay? So therefore, you shouldn't develop disenchantment with cyclic existence. Okay? That's what this person's thinking. And to support their view, what this person does is they quote the sutra showing the Tathagata's inconceivable secret. So that sutra states, bodhisattvas, thinking of the maturation of living beings, view cyclic existence as beneficial. Accordingly, they do not view great nirvana, or liberation, as beneficial to the maturation of beings. So this quote from the sutra saying that bodhisattvas, when they think of the maturation of living beings, in other words, the Dharma maturing or ripening of sentient beings' minds, view cyclic existence as beneficial. So that, you know, you bring in a sutra quote and you say, look, Buddha agrees with my point. Okay, and they also give another quote that says, were bodhisattvas to fear involvement in cyclic existence, they would fall to a destitute place. And then they bring another quote. Okay, this guy really, you know, is like saying, my view's right. Okay. So the other quote says, Bhagawan, whereas the hearers fear involvement in cyclic existence, bodhisattvas voluntarily take innumerable rebirths in cyclic existence. So then you say, well, yeah. You know, bodhisattvas take innumerable rebirths in cyclic existence. And if bodhisattvas were so fed up with cyclic existence, they wouldn't do that. And so since they have to take rebirth in cyclic existence to benefit sentient beings, then they can't develop renunciation of cyclic existence. So they shouldn't meditate on the 12 links and, you know, the disadvantages of cyclic existence. It seems reasonable, huh? Yeah? What do you think? No? Why not? How are you going to refute this guy? Okay, one big mouth said this. What are you going to say to him? Yeah?
Well, the bodhisattvas wouldn't have that level of compassion that they need to help beings if they don't have that level of disgust for samsara. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it seems like it's two different things. You know, one is to have disgust with samsara, and another is to be willing to forego leaving it all behind in order to stay and help people.
Mm. Okay. So saying that bodhisattvas, to cultivate that compassion, need to meditate on the disadvantages of cyclic existence and have that understanding in terms of self and others to develop a bodhisattva's compassion. Okay. And at the same time, the bodhisattvas are foregoing their own instant, quicker nirvana or liberation in order to stay in cyclic existence and benefit sentient beings. Okay. Now, what do you think about that? You know, if you had really intense big fed-upness with cyclic existence, is it going to be easy to forego your own liberation to stay in cyclic existence and help all these people who don't appreciate you enough and don't love you enough and betray your trust and insult you? Is that going to be easy to do? Yeah, you need a pretty strong mind to do that. Yeah, and you really need to be able to somehow see sentient beings in beauty, because if all the time you're looking at sentient beings, you're thinking, I'm giving up my own nirvana to stay and help this ungrateful jerk. You know, are you going to really be able to remain as a bodhisattva if you think like that? No. Okay. That this is kind of our present thing, what we do, don't we? Yeah. You know, I'm giving up my own happiness to help you. Yeah. This is the parental guilt trip.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah? Yeah? Any of you hear this when you were kids? Maybe only certain ethnic groups. Who have the PhD in guilt tripping. Yeah? I'm giving this up for your benefit, you unworthy, unappreciative, ungrateful idiot. You know? Okay, so we have to really have bodhicitta. We can't think like that. That's not going to work. Okay, so we have to really see sentient beings in beauty and remember their kindness over and over and over again. Okay, again and again and again and again. Think of sentient beings' kindness. Okay. And also, remember that lots of times when we get angry at sentient beings, it's not that they're deliberately trying to harm us. Even if they were deliberately trying to harm us, that still isn't a good reason to get angry. But lots of times we use it as a reason, oh, they're trying to harm me. But if we look closer, we'll see actually they're not. For example, you know, your friend is, or your spouse or whoever it is cooking dinner, and dinner's late and you're hungry, so you get irritated. You know, dinner's supposed to be ready at 6 o'clock and it's not ready and I'm hungry. Okay? And we think our anger is justified. Actually, that person is doing something kind for us, aren't they? They're cooking us dinner. But we don't see their kindness in cooking us dinner. What we see is they're not cooking dinner fast enough. Okay? If you're working on a project with somebody at work, yeah, and they have a different idea than you, or they don't turn in their part of the project by the time that you need it, you get angry. But actually, they're on your team working on the project with you, trying to help you. It's not like they're trying to sabotage the project. They just aren't doing it in the way that you want them to do it, or aren't doing it fast enough. But they're trying to help. Okay. So, you know, anger is a big enemy for developing compassion. So it's very good to do a little bit of questioning our reasons for getting angry to see if they hold. Lots of times they don't. Okay, so that's what one mouth said. Yeah? So let's see. Leah had her way of answering the question. Let's see what Jay Rinpoche says, if it corresponds here. Okay, so the first sentence starts out, this is a great error that misconstrues the sutra's meaning. For the sutra passage that says, thus bodhisattvas should not become disenchanted with cyclic existence, does not teach bodhisattvas not to be disgusted with the sufferings of birth, aging, illness, and death, and so on, the result of our wandering through cyclic existence under the influence of our karma and afflictions. Okay, so he's saying that isn't the meaning of those sutra passages that the person quoted. Rather, this sutra teaches joyous perseverance. In order to train in the bodhisattva's activities for the sake of others until the end of cyclic existence, bodhisattvas must put on armor. Okay, so the joyous effort that is armor-like, it means having a courageous mind, a very strong mind. Once the bodhisattvas do this, even if all the sufferings of all sentient beings were collected, and the bodhisattvas constantly experience them all mentally and physically, they would still persevere joyously, delighting in the magnificent deeds that help others, without becoming disenchanted with or frightened by suffering. Okay? So Jay Rinpoche is saying that if you have, you know, the bodhicitta is understood right in your mind, and you have a lot of joyous effort, your mind becomes very courageous and strong. So then, even if you were to take all the sufferings of all living beings upon yourself, like you do in the, you imagine doing in the taking and giving meditation, but even if you were to be able to actually do it and experience all the miseries of sentient beings yourself, bodhisattvas would be thrilled to do it. Okay? And they wouldn't be disenchanted or frightened by suffering. Yeah. Now imagine having that mind. Yeah. We have to go to the dentist. We are frightened by suffering. Okay? But imagine not even being frightened of our own suffering, and then not being frightened to be able to bear the suffering of others. And in fact, for you, doing this, because you're intent, you're so focused and you have so much compassion for sentient beings, that the idea of taking on your suffering, their suffering, you go, wow, this is great. Yeah? On the plane I was taking down to Sacramento, you know? No, this was when I went to see my parents. We were landing in Orange County. The flight attendant said, how many of you are going to Disneyland? Because there were a lot of kids on the plane. So all these kids go, oh, we're going to Disneyland. Well, this is how a bodhisattva feels. Inside the existence. Oh! I am so excited about bearing the suffering of sentient beings. You know, this is so wonderful. What a fantastic thing I get to do today. Now, wouldn't that be wonderful to be able to have that kind of attitude? Wouldn't you love to have that kind of attitude? When I think of it, I just think, my goodness, you know? What an incredibly happy, wonderful, meaningful mind to have, where you're not frightened by your own or others' suffering, and where you see doing that as pleasure. How happy and joyful your mind must be. And how, no matter what anybody ever did to you, you're never going to get upset by it. Because if you can derive my joy from having that level of compassion, there's no way you're ever, ever, ever going to get bummed out and depressed. Yeah? So what an incredible antidote to depression, having compassion for others.
One mouth wants to say something.
Okay. We have another mouth over here. Yes?
I was confused about the part that says that suffering is important to the maturation of human beings and how the bodhisattvas think about that in terms of all the rest of the stuff.
Okay, so she's asking about that first sutra quote. It said bodhisattvas, addressing the bodhisattvas, thinking of the maturation of living beings, view cyclic existence as beneficial. So what that's meaning is that if you're intent on ripening sentient beings' minds, on maturing their minds in the Dharma, then you see it as beneficial for yourself to stay in cyclic existence.
Wasn't there a part about suffering as beneficial for the maturation of...
No. No, it didn't say that suffering was beneficial. No. Yeah. Okay. So then he quotes, thus the Buddha said that bodhisattvas must not be disenchanted with cyclic existence. Okay? So in one way, they're disenchanted with their own cyclic existence and they want to get out of it. But in another way, they're willing to forego their own liberation and continue to stay in cyclic existence in order to benefit others. That doesn't mean that bodhisattvas never attain enlightenment, because they see actually that it is more beneficial for them to attain enlightenment than to not attain it. Okay, so they're striving very diligently to attain enlightenment. But samsara is the playground in which they create the merit, the positive potential, to become a Buddha. You know, because the path to Buddhahood entails a lot more than the path to become an arhat. Yeah? It's you have to work longer and you have to work harder. But when you think of the results and you think of that incredible noble state of mind of compassion, it's like, okay, it doesn't matter. You know, however long it takes, whatever I have to do, whatever I have to go through, I want that state of mind. Yeah? And I want to be able to make my life beneficial for sentient beings like that. Yeah? And when I think of it, it's just like, wow, what an incredible mind bodhisattvas must have. Incredible. You know?
I don't want to interrupt, but it's okay to ask you a question. So I just hung up when you said earlier about it's difficult, do bodhisattvas find it difficult or something weird like that. So my thought is, so to me it's like they're already a bodhisattva, so that doesn't enter their thought. Mm-hmm. So once they're bodhisattva, are they reevaluating minute by minute, or once they become a bodhisattva, do they just kind of flow with it?
Okay, so you're saying once somebody becomes a bodhisattva, is there any chance of falling back from it, and do they ever get, you know, depressed or discouraged along the way? Okay, there's different levels of bodhisattvas, okay, starting from the path of accumulation, path of preparation, then the 10 bodhisattva bhumis, okay. On the very early stages of the path of accumulation, it's possible to lose your bodhicitta. You know? And you know, you just get fed up with some sentient being and you say, scratch that one off. You know, I'm not getting enlightenment, gonna go through this enlightenment business to help this one. You know? And if you think like that, you've broken your bodhisattva vow. Yeah, and you've lost your bodhicitta, and they say it's a direct ticket to the lower realm. Okay? So that one you don't want to do. Okay. Why is it a direct ticket to the lower realm? Yeah, nonstop. Why? Because when we take bodhisattva vows, we are promising all sentient beings to work for their benefit. Now, just even on an ordinary level, if we promise somebody something, is it good to break our promise? No. That's promising one sentient being some small thing. Yeah? But if you promise all sentient beings some big thing, like helping them to get enlightened, then if you break that promise, you know, you're self-sabotaging. Yeah. So the lower rebirth is not a punishment for that. But it's just you can see in your own mind that you're going against your own intention. Yeah, so it's totally self-sabotaging. They say that happened to Shariputra, but then somehow he didn't wind, I don't know, he purified or he did something because he wasn't reborn in the lower realms. Okay. So then Master Chandrakirti says, this is a quote from Chandrakirti, bodhisattvas who take on the suffering of all beings moment by moment until the end of cyclic existence do not fear harm to their bodies or minds. Wouldn't it be wonderful to feel like that? To not fear harm to your body and mind. Bodhisattvas who take on the sufferings of all beings simultaneously until the end of cyclic existence delight in this activity. Think about, you know, you delight in taking on suffering. Imagine how much you would delight if there were happiness. I mean, think of how happy a bodhisattva's mind must be. How they've worked so hard to be able to transform their mind. Each instant of such joyous perseverance acts as the cause whose effect produces boundless collections of wealth, bringing omniscience to all beings. Once bodhisattvas understand this, it is appropriate for them to take hundreds of rebirths. Okay, so when you really understand, you know, that taking hundreds of rebirths and practicing, you know, very hard, bearing whatever hardships come your way is the way to attain final enlightenment, then that makes your mind strong and you're able to do it. It's an analogy is when you see that when you get a certain degree, you're going to make, you know, X amount of money, and you really want to make that money because you're thinking of all the nice things you're going to get when you make that 100,000, okay, then you have a lot of energy to stay up late studying on your exams, don't you? Don't you? Yeah? You know, there's a party. You skip the party. You know, I'm going to stay up late and study on my exams, and I'm going to read all this extra material, and I'm going to do all this extra credit work because then I'll get this degree, and then I'll make the money, and then I'll get all these things that I want. Okay? So you see that when you see something as beneficial, the mind naturally becomes very strong in creating the causes to attain it. So when we see enlightenment as beneficial, when we see the joy and happiness of all loving beings as beneficial, okay, then the mind, you know, the strength of the enthusiastic perseverance increases in our own mind, and then that makes it easy to do the practice. So one thing that I've started doing is because I have a lot of respect for bodhisattvas, I just think of like what their mind must be like, and it's like, that's my role model. That's who I want to be like. You know, long way to go, but that's who I want to be like. Okay, then I have a situation in which somebody's like rude to me or disrespectful or unappreciative or, you know, any number of things. And then, you know, my first reaction is always poor me. And then I stop and I go, this person is helping me to make my mind strong. Because if I'm going to be a bodhisattva, I've got to be able to bear this. And I've actually got to be able to bear stuff that's a lot worse than this. You know, somebody being a little bit disrespectful, that's really not so painful. It's my own mind that's making it painful. The person's not really doing anything. You know, somebody not appreciating me. You know, I mean, why do I get so bummed out about it? You know? I mean, that's their mind. Why am I being unhappy? It's not really that painful. So, you know, it's my mind creating that pain. So then I think, well, you know, a bodhisattva, they bear this stuff all the time. And then you think of the Dalai Lama, you know. Yeah, you think you get called names? Look what the communist Chinese government calls the Dalai Lama, you know. And why does he need so much security around him? Because there's people who, you know, see him as an enemy. It's incredible. You know, somebody having so much compassion and yet other people's minds so twisted that they can't see it. Yeah? So, and yet His Holiness hangs around for our benefit, and they do so until the end of samsara. Yeah? So, you know, he has to bear this. And it's not like, you know, sometimes people think the Dalai Lama is like the Popo, you know, do this, then everybody says this, yes, yes. It's not like that. You know, people say yes to His Holiness, and then they go do what they want. You know? And I look at my own teachers, and sometimes how disciples treat my own teachers. You look at anybody in this world who's trying to help people, you know? And, you know, you look at what Al Gore did with his, you know, An Inconvenient Truth. And now somebody's, you know, putting together a whole thing of, rebuttal, putting together a rebooting, a rebuttal. Is there a verb? He's rebutting it. Anyway, he's doing that kind of thing. Yeah. So it's just, you know, the same thing. You know, here's somebody trying to do good, then they meet all these obstacles, this and that, people saying this and that, calling you names and blah blah blah. And so if you just say, okay, this is practice for becoming a bodhisattva. Yeah, this person's helping me practice to make my mind strong so I can become a bodhisattva. So I can bear this. You know, it's really not so bad. If you think about it, the stuff that we get really upset and depressed about, it's really not that bad. Okay. So in order to emphasize this point, Chandrakirti then cites the aforementioned sutra passages from the Sutra of Showing the Tathagata's Inconceivable Secret. So what he's saying is that this guy, you know, the first big mouth we had here, was had taken those sutra passages out of context and hadn't understood them correctly. Okay? This same sutra states that cyclic existence should be viewed as beneficial because bodhisattvas gain happiness proportionate to the effort they make when they strive for the welfare of living beings. So the harder you work for the welfare of living beings, the more happiness you experience. Okay? Really, you can see why this is an antidote to depression. You know, because when we're depressed, who are we thinking about? Me. Me, 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 me. You know, when we're compassionate, who are we thinking about? Everybody else. Just the act of taking the focus off of ourselves and opening our eyes and seeing others, just that heals depression. Yeah. Okay. Hence, the Buddha says that not being disenchanted with cyclic existence means not being disenchanted with accomplishing the good of living beings in cyclic existence, as well as enjoying this activity. Okay, should I read that one again?
Yeah.
Hence, the Buddha says, now let's read the whole paragraph. The same sutra states that cyclic existence should be viewed as beneficial because bodhisattvas gain happiness proportionate to the effort they make when they strive for the welfare of sentient beings. Hence, the Buddha says that not being disenchanted with cyclic existence means not being disenchanted with accomplishing the good of living beings in cyclic existence, as well as enjoying this activity. Okay? So, in other words, when the Buddha says, talks about bodhisattvas not being disenchanted with cyclic existence, what he means is that bodhisattvas shouldn't be disenchanted with helping sentient beings within cyclic existence and should it actually enjoy helping them. Okay. When you wander through cyclic existence by the power of karma and afflictions, you are tormented by many sufferings. If you are unable to accomplish even your own aims, what need is there to mention that you cannot accomplish those of others? In other words, if you stay under the influence of afflictions and karma, you can't liberate yourself, so there's no talk about liberating others. Okay. Since such wandering is the door to all problems, bodhisattvas must be even more disenchanted with cyclic existence than practitioners of the fundamental vehicle, and must stop their own wandering caused by karma and the afflictions. Nevertheless, bodhisattvas must enjoy being reborn in cyclic existence through their aspirational prayers and compassion. These two ways of being reborn are not the same. Okay? So there's rebirth in cyclic existence under the power of afflictions and karma, And there's rebirth in cyclic existence due to aspirational prayers and compassion. These are very, very different. Okay? We are reborn under the influence of afflictions and karma, so we have no freedom, and we're subjected to all the miseries of cyclic existence. Lower level bodhisattvas, okay, the ones on the path of accumulation and the path of preparation, they're still reborn in cyclic existence under the influence of karma and afflictions. Once you get to the path of seeing, the third path, where you have direct realization of emptiness, then you're no longer born in cyclic existence due to karma and afflictions, but due to your compassion and your prayers, then you deliberately take rebirth. And who you get reborn as, you know, because you still have all this karma of the 12 links that you've created before. That karma's still in your mind stream. It's not going to ripen due to craving and grasping anymore, because you've eliminated, you know, not eliminated, but you've reduced the ignorance and the craving and the grasping. So that's not going to ripen. But those seeds, there's still karmic connections with different beings and still seeds for different rebirths. So bodhisattvas at that level of the practice, through their compassion, they can make certain karmic seeds ripen, and that's why they might get reborn as a child in one family or another. Okay? So it's like transforming that karma, still using it, but now due to their aspirational prayers and their compassion. And then they get born in cyclic existence, you know, our world. And these same level bodhisattvas from path of seeing on up, then they can create many, many emanations. So then, you know, they emanate many, many bodies to beings in different places. Okay. Failing to make this distinction, okay, between being reborn due to afflictions and karma and being reborn due to aspirational prayers and compassion, failing to make this distinction leads to the qualms like that above. The bodhisattva levels, that's a text by Asanga, says that if the proponents of such a position have taken the vows of a bodhisattva, then they have committed a great misdeed permeated with afflictions. However, fearing too many words, I will not quote the passage in full. Okay, so what he's saying is don't think like that big mouth. Yeah? Hence, it is amazing that bodhisattvas see the defects of cyclic existence and are thoroughly disgusted, yet do not give up their vow because they are motivated by great compassion. Isn't that incredible? You know, seeing all this disadvantage of cyclic existence, but they don't just choose for their own liberation because they're hooked by compassion. If those who seek the wonders of cyclic existence as like a... If those who see the wonders of cyclic existence as like a celestial mansion without reducing their craving even in the slightest, if those people claim to be serving others, how could their unwillingness to abandon cyclic existence please the wise? Okay? So if we're one of these people who say we have renunciation, but actually we think samsara is great, But we claim to be big, you know, greatly compassionate people. That's not going to help. That's not going to please the wise ones. Okay. As Baba Viveka in his Heart of the Middle Way says, since bodhisattvas see the faults of cyclic existence, they do not remain here. Because they care for others, they do not remain in nirvana. In order to fulfill the needs of others, they resolve to remain in cyclic existence. Okay, so since they see the faults of cyclic existence, they don't remain in it. In other words, that bodhisattvas are constantly trying to free themselves from cyclic existence. Okay, because they care for others, they don't remain in self-complacent peace of nirvana, their own nirvana. In order to fulfill the needs of others, they resolve to remain in cyclic existence. Okay? And so that's why we say that full Buddhahood, we call it non-abiding nirvana. Because the Buddhas don't abide in cyclic existence, and they don't abide in their own self-complacent nirvana. Okay? That's why it's called non-abiding nirvana, and it's the nirvana of a fully enlightened one. Once you see the limitless sufferings of all living beings, such as the 110 sufferings explained in the Bodhisattva levels, you allow this to be the cause for great compassion. At this time, when you cultivate a heart that has a forceful and enduring inability to withstand the sight of others' sufferings, it would be contradictory to not even be slightly disenchanted with cyclic existence. Okay, so if you're going to have that much compassion, you've got to have some renunciation. The theme of Aryadeva's 400 stanzas, which, by the way, is an incredible text, and His Holiness is teaching it in Germany, in Hamburg, this summer, if any of you have the opportunity to go. Aryadeva is one of Nagarjuna's disciples, and this text, the 400, is spectacular. It's really one of my favorites. Anyway, Jay Rinpoche is saying, the theme of Aryadeva's 400 stanzas is the stages of the path upon which bodhisattvas develop great revulsion for cyclic existence, and then, seeing living beings as their close relatives, enter the ocean of cyclic existence for their sake. So seeing living beings as their very dear, precious relatives. Maybe in America we have to think very dear, precious friends. You know, but whoever it is that you hold as precious, that's how you see sentient beings. Okay. Then you voluntarily go on the ocean of cyclic existence for their sake. In his commentary on that work, the great master Chandrakirti clarifies this. So again, here's a quote. Due to the Buddha's explanation of the faults of cyclic existence, his disciples learn to fear it and desire freedom from it. The Bhagavan said the following so that they would develop a strong connection to the Mahayana. O monastics, among all who have passed through cyclic existence for a long time, there is not one being among all the various types of living beings who has not been like a father, mother, son, daughter, relative, or step relation to you. Okay? So the Buddha is saying that we have been related to every single living being. Yeah. Saddam Hussein, Adolf Hitler, your boss, your ex-husband, the guy at the grocery store, the guy at the gas station, the spider in the bathroom, the cockroach in the kitchen, the dog who's barking when you're trying to sleep. They've all been our very dear beloved ones. And they're all under the afflictions of samsara. Yeah. Under the power of afflictions and karma. So that makes compassion. Then Chandrakirti also said, by understanding the words of the Bhagavan, that's another epitaph of the Buddha, bodhisattvas are able to leap into the ocean of cyclic existence. Can you imagine that? Like a kid at the edge of the ocean going, woo! You know how you do it at the ocean? Oh, it's so much fun to go riding. So that's how bodhisattvas leap into the ocean of cyclic existence. They do this so that all beings who have been their close relatives, like fathers and mothers, throughout beginningless time, and who are now bereft and without a protector, may be freed by the boat of the Mahayana. The Chandrakirti says. Then Jay Rinpoche continues, the unsurpassed mantra vehicle, so practicing Vajrayana, also requires this method. So you have to have the bodhicitta motivation. For as Aryadeva says in his lamp, which is a compendium of deeds, and here's the quote from Aryadeva, through these stages, you should engage in these activities wholly free of elaboration. The stages for doing this are as follows. In the very beginning, you should recall the beginningless sufferings of cyclic existence, and then desire the bliss of nirvana. Therefore, you should completely give up all agitation and even cultivate the idea that the rulers of kingdoms suffer. Okay? The interesting thing, the first sentence here, okay, the later part, he's talking about, you know, the suffering of sentient beings and recalling beginningless suffering. That's the compassionate side. But his first sentence in the quote, through these stages, you should engage in these activities wholly free of elaborations. Okay? Elaborations means the elaborations of inherent existence. Okay? Elaborations means what we projected onto sentient beings. So much so that it's appearing back to us. The appearance of inherent existence, that's elaboration. Because elaboration is where you put more on than is what is there, right? So things that are dependently arising, we put something extra on them and we make them into inherently existent things. So Aryadeva is saying, when you're doing these bodhisattva practices, developing compassion, try and do it with an awareness of emptiness and dependent arising. Okay? And if you do that, if you're able to see that suffering is empty of inherent existence, then your fear of suffering is going to go way, way, way down. Yeah? Because what makes suffering difficult is our grasping at inherent existence.